Welcome to the Archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. This program is the second in a two-part series on psychiatry with Dr. Richard Gardner, a practicing psychiatrist in Ukiah, California. In this program, we discuss psychotropic medications, what they seem to do, issues that may cause mental dysfunction, and what resources were available in 1997 to treat mental illness. We began when I asked Dr. Gardner about the medications that were available at that time to treat people with psychiatric illnesses.
I'd like to step back a moment from the question and talk about the types of psychiatric illness and then to talk about the medications that are available.
That apply to the different types.
Yes. And basically, my own categorization system is very simple. I look at three different major areas and then a miscellaneous category. And of the three areas, the kind of people who I see in my practice, the vast majority of them suffer from what we call mood disorders. The second category would be anxiety disorders, and the third category is thought disorders, and then there's miscellaneous categories past that. But I think just by covering those three, I would have encompassed more than 9 out of 10 of the people who I see. And mood disorders are where people have problems where their feelings are not feelings that they are happy with. So they're either sad, what we call that depressed, when it's been going on for a period of more than 2 weeks, and when it seems to be that the depression, that the sad feeling, the blue, the unhappy feeling has taken over the person. And then there's also a condition that's now called bipolar disorder, and that used to be called manic depressive illness, and it's the same, it's just different names for the same thing. And bipolar disorder is a condition of mood swings where there are usually alternations between feeling in an expanded, elevated, or irritable mood that alternate with feelings of feeling depressed, sad, or blue. And the swings can be on a monthly basis or a once or twice a year basis, or they can be as frequent as several times in one day. And people can, in fact, be simultaneously be in an elevated, expansive mood and be very irritable and actually feel very unhappy. So the person can be saying, I'm the king of the universe, I'm wonderful, but feeling very sad and empty and unhappy inside of them. Those are the mood disorders. Those are two of the most common mood disorders. There are others. Then there are anxiety disorders, and anxiety disorders fall into two basic categories in my mind also. One is chronic anxiety, nervousness, tension, that is baseline, that's there all the time. And the other is intermittent anxiety. And the intermittent anxiety is that in between the episodes of anxiety, the person does not feel nervous, tense, or anxious.
Let's describe anxiety. Nervous, tense, anxious.
Okay.
Is that it?
Yes, but there's more to it than that when we haven't gotten to the thought disorders, but we'll hold that in mind, in those storing it in those 100 million neurons, billion neurons in our brains. But the feelings, I look at anxiety actually as a signal from the brain to the brain, in other words, from the person, that says, pay attention, something's wrong, something needs to be attended to. If everything's going all right, most people are in what I call an unconscious state. They're not conscious of the fact that one leg is crossed over the other, that their pen is in their mouth. I'm describing Barry to our listening audience.
As we're sitting here talking.
Or they're smiling. They're not conscious of that, or they don't feel the pressure of the seat that they're sitting on against their rear end. And it's only when something's wrong, so that your leg is starting to fall asleep or you're starting to feel a crimp in your neck, then you move, that you are temporarily conscious of that, and then you go back into an unconscious state. Well, if there's something that isn't being attended to, and it could be anything from the fact that your arm's falling asleep to the fact that you want to get out of the job that you're in, or that you're thinking about maybe I should return the money to the bank before they find out that I've stolen it from them, whatever it is of various degrees of importance, the brain sends a signal to itself. So it's a message from you to you, saying pay attention. And that signal we see as anxiety. It's an alerting system that says, watch out, pay attention. If that signal is paid attention to and the money is returned to the bank, or you uncross your legs and cross them over the other way, that anxious feeling goes away. If you don't pay attention to it and it persists, then one has a condition we call an anxiety state. And that's in a constant state of arousal. If I told you that there were going to be masked bandits breaking into this room anytime in the next 10 minutes, you would get into an arousal state, and we'd call that high anxiety or nervousness or tension. But if you were sitting here and 4 weeks later no one had broken in the room, by that time your guard would go down and you wouldn't be nervous. But in some people that signal keeps going, even though there's no external reason for it.
Even though there's no reason to be nervous. But also in some people, the signal is not recognized. It's okay to take money from the bank and not return it.
Well, that's a different situation, and that would be in one of those miscellaneous categories that I referred to before, and we would call that a person without a conscience, as someone who has what is now called antisocial personality disorder, previously called psychopathic personality disorder. So the person who could, I mean, even take money from the bank and say, oh, the banks, they're rich, you know, I can use it more than they can.
And would that include people who are in the courts called criminally insane?
No.
Where would they fit in?
Criminally insane, and now...
And that's a pretty vague term.
Well, this is interesting that we have a lawyer talking to a psychiatrist about the criminally insane, but criminally insane is not a psychiatric term.
It's a legal term.
It's a legal term.
To put people in a certain way because they don't fit in other ways.
And psychiatrists do this all the time in terms of trying to put people into a certain category, because once we know what we call someone, then we can say that the treatment that they're going to get would be similar to the treatment that we would call someone else in another part of the country or another part of the hospital who has the same condition, that we could apply that treatment and hope that it works. So that if when you're calling someone depressed and I would call them psychotic and we apply the same treatment, we're not comparing the same thing. So we like to have diagnostic categories, and those are the general categories that I was talking about of mood disorders, anxiety disorders,
And thought disorders. Well, let's get to thought disorders.
Well, I didn't finish with anxiety disorders.
Okay, all right, let's don't move yet.
People with intermittent anxiety disorders, and we call that, for instance, panic attacks. So people have a sudden burst of high anxiety that there is usually no externally visible cause. And it may be that something has been triggered in them unconsciously, but they have all of that arousal as if the masked bandits were going to walk in the room any moment. Or people have situational anxieties, and the most common one is phobias such as fear of public speaking, or social phobia, people who are just afraid to be out in public, a very underdiagnosed condition. And a lot of people who have it think it's just them, but if they could talk to enough social phobics, they would find out, or enough people, they would find out that many people suffer from an intense fear, phobia, of being in a public place, being in among other people.
An interesting catch-22.
Yes, right. And the social phobics have an annual meeting every year. And the International Social Phobic Society has 3 members, but there are many people who have that condition. Moving on to thought disorders. And remember, all of these are brain functions. Remember, the brain controls how we feel, so that's mood disorders, and how we behave, and so there could be movement disorders that people have where they make strange, bizarre, stereotypic movements, or that feeling of anxiety, or most fundamentally, thought disorders. And those are the people who you as a lawyer would call insane or crazy, the public would call it, but the correct medical term for that would be psychotic. And what is psychotic? Psychotic is a term that refers to people who are having usually one of 2 symptoms. And the first symptom would be hallucinations. And hallucinations are defined as perceptions that are untrue and that have no basis in reality. So if I look in this room and say, Barry, see that pink elephant that's there, and there's nothing there, just air, then I'm having a hallucination. If I say, can't you hear the angels singing in this room, and there's no noise whatsoever in this room, then those are hallucinations. One would be a visual one, which is typical of a medication overdose, not from psychiatric medications usually, but from medications that are called anticholinergic. And the some psychiatric medications are, by the way, anticholinergic. And the other would be an auditory hallucination where people are hearing voices, and that's a cardinal symptom of inherent psychotic illness such as schizophrenia or a bipolar or a depressive person who's having a psychotic break.
When you take that to the religious scale, it's okay if you talk to God, if you think there's a God. But it's not okay if you say God is talking to me and commanding certain behavior, at least in our society.
Well, it depends on what the behavior is. If the behavior is go out and lead your life in a certain way so that you will become a saint and enough people consensually agree with you, then that's acceptable. It's only when people have their own psychosis that is unique to them and that isn't believed by other people. So religion is a matter of faith. It's not a testable thing. But it's not a matter of faith if I say the Martians are out to get me because it's going to be hard for me to get enough people to agree with me.
But if God tells you that the Martians are out to get you, or God tells you to go tell everyone you are a saint, and you get in people's face on the street...
Well, then that's the behavior that's getting me in trouble. If I want to sit here and think that God has told me that I'm a saint and not do anything about it, I won't get in trouble for it. So thought disorders are either hallucinations, as we said, or delusions, and you referred to delusions. And delusions are fixed, false beliefs that are not shared by other people. So they are beliefs that most people, the reasonable person on the street, would say, that is not so, that is not true. So if I say, I am 9 feet tall, and I am as powerful as Superman, and you look at me and here I am, I'm not even 6 feet tall, and not quite as strong as Superman, then you'll say, Gardner, you have a delusion. And if I say, you know, you're right, Barry, I'm really not that strong, then it's not a delusion anymore. But if I say, despite all evidence to the contrary, yes, I am 9 feet tall, then that's a delusion. And so there are treatments, medical treatments, for all three of these categories, the mood disorders, the anxiety disorders, and the thought disorders.
Before we get into those medical treatments and what they can do and how they're available here in Mendocino County, I want to say that my guest this week is Dr. Richard Gardner, a psychiatrist in Ukiah. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel.
Curiosity is a brain function. It's one of the things that really drives us. It's the desire to know more about things that we don't know. And there's some people who aren't very curious and they're content with what they know or what they think they know. And it befuddles me that people can be some people can be so uncurious. But the vast majority of people want to know. If you tell them a story and you get all the way to the punchline and it's been a good story so far, there are very few people who will walk away and say, I don't care what the punchline was. So that's that curiosity that pushes us along. So in terms of medication, there are many medications that are used for the depressive disorders or for the bipolar disorders. And some of the medications that are used for bipolar can be used for depression. And some of the medications that are used for depression, the antidepressants, so named, can actually cause bipolar episodes. And I don't push medication. Medication is just one way of helping people to feel better about themselves and to function better and to feel like they can think better and actually to think better.
Well, there's two kinds of medication. There's kinds that are prescribed by a person like yourself who has an overview and a specific training. And then there's self-medications where people try and determine what they need because someone says, hey, use this, it'll help you out. Mm-hmm. And then there's a whole bunch of other chemicals that we take without a thought.
Right.
Or we're subjected to without a thought.
Well, I've read that 85% of American adults drink caffeinated beverages. So 85% of American adults are taking a chemical, caffeine, to make their brain think faster or clearer or to keep them more alert. And I'm not making any judgment on that, but it's interesting that we have a society that has such a popular chemical. And if you look cross-culturally at many other societies, there are caffeinated beverages around the world that people use to increase mental alertness. And there's no problem when there's a slight increase of mental alertness. The problem is when someone is completely wired on 40 cups a day, or some people can get stimulated at a lower dose and then they can't withdraw from it and they have side effects, so they have gastric upset or they have insomnia from it, and they might not even be aware that the cause of their problems is actually something that they're doing to themselves. Whenever we do anything, there's always a benefit-risk analysis. I was doing physical exercise this morning, and I pulled a muscle while I was doing the exercise to try to make my body more healthy, and what I've done is I can just barely walk today. And there's a benefit-risk, so it's the same thing when I prescribe a medication. There's a cost to it, so people have to spend money, which means they worked for their... They spent their time working to make money, and now they're using it to take a chemical. There's side effects that are possible. Some of the medicines don't work. Some of the medicines cause other problems. But by and large, when one goes to a trained professional and has a prescription, if the diagnosis was right and if the medication was chosen wisely, the person is likely to have a beneficial reaction to the medication rather than the person who says, well, I'm having trouble falling asleep, so I've found that a couple of beers will help me to fall asleep. And yes, they may help him to fall asleep, or her, but then they wind up waking up a few hours later with rebound insomnia and having worse sleep, having worse quality sleep.
Well, let's talk about some of those self-medications. Beers, methamphetamine, ecstasy, LSD, marijuana.
Yeah, the first thing is I don't like the term self-medication. The self part's okay, but I like to use the term... First of all, I prefer... neutral terms such as chemicals, okay, because everything's chemical, be it a Snickers bar or be it a beer or ecstasy or whatever it is. But in terms of medication versus drugs, and I use that word drugs, I mean it has a heavy sound to it, the medications in doing a benefit-risk analysis for people's functioning, and that is the way they think, the way they feel, and the way they behave, the analysis comes out in that it will be a favorable interaction with that chemical. And with the drugs...
Presumed. Hoped for.
Well, it's that statistically it will turn out more likely to be good for the person than bad for the person. Whereas these things that we call drugs, like nicotine or like alcohol or like caffeine or methamphetamine or lysergic acid, diethylamide, whatever it is, the likelihood, or tetrahydrocannabinol, the likelihood is that there'll be more problems with it than benefit gained. And people may be listening and saying, well, I've been smoking a joint every night for the last 30 years, and I don't see any problems. And yes, there's some people get away with anything. There's some people say, well, I always drive 90 going down to Santa Rosa, and I've always gotten there faster, and I never got a ticket. Okay, but there may be some day when you're either going to get a ticket or you're not going to wind up in Santa Rosa because you have a collision that wouldn't have occurred had you been driving more slowly.
So how do you address people who are having a terrible time with what's going on, either through anxiety disorders or mood disorders or thought disorders, and they want to smoke a joint or they want some meth to cover those problems?
Well, I find, just in my experience, that illicit chemical use is more often detrimental than salutary for people. And I find that it interferes with treatment. And if they're having the troubles and they're doing the drugs, I would like to say if they want help, then something's wrong. And the way they can get things to be better will be to do a cleaner experiment. And that experiment would be to stop doing the drugs and then to see if perhaps the drugs were causing the problems. And if the problems go away, then they don't need my help. They've already cured themselves. That's self-medication, stopping doing the methamphetamine. And if they stop the drugs, be it a few beers, whatever that means per night, or a few tokes, or a few limes, or whatever they're doing, if they stop that, and then a month later they're still having problems, then they can come to me and we can work together to see what else may be going on. Because in that what we call dual diagnosis, where there's a mental illness and a substance abuse problem, there have been debates back and forth and articles and studies that different people have different opinions, but it could be that the substances are causing the mental illness or the mental illness is causing the substance use. And there's a high, what we call comorbidity. Both exist at the same time.
What is a person to do when they suspect that someone they care about is off the deep end?
Oh, is that a new legal term?
The deep end.
The deep end. I wonder what it would be like.
No reference to Anderson Valley, of course.
Okay, well, I wonder what it would be like to be off the shallow end. But
okay.
That they've gone beyond what you would expect to be normal human behavior.
That's right.
Well, The oldest joke about psychiatrists, which I believe is, how many psychiatrists does it take to change a light bulb? One. But the light bulb has to want to change. So the person who's gone off the deep end, if they are dysphoric, meaning if they are unhappy with their lot, and they're willing to come and get help, then there's many different avenues for, ranging from the county mental health department to the Mendocino Community Health Clinic's mental health department. That's a private clinic that provides care. There are two partial psychiatric hospitalization programs in this town, Transitions of Ukiah, which mainly is aimed at elderly folks with problems, and Behavioral Health of Ukiah, which has a cognitive behavioral approach. There are four psychiatrists that I'm aware of in private practice in the inland part of this county, and there are two or three on the coast. And then there's a panoply of other mental health providers, not psychiatrists, but psychologists, social workers, marriage and family counselors, pastors, whatever, who can provide some sort of care for people.
And if the person that one is concerned about won't go to see one of you?
Well, we believe in certain freedoms in this culture of ours, and one has the freedom to be quietly unhappy by themselves. You can't be quietly, you can't be noisily unhappy by yourself. You can't get a trumpet and march down State Street in the middle of the night playing your trumpet and saying, I'm wonderful, because you'll get in trouble, and you'll either wind up in the Mendocino County Correctional Facility or you'll wind up in the Mendocino Psychiatric Facility. And it's when you start butting heads with other people that you get into problems.
Well, then let's go on to a situation where a person has a routine of medications that keeps them fairly content and fairly well under control within the normal bounds of what's expected in our society or what is not disallowed. And then they stop taking their meds.
Well, oftentimes there's a reason that they stop taking the medication, and it could be anything from the medication they felt was doing them more harm than good, which may be a correct assessment or it may be an incorrect assessment. It could be that even though they felt the medication was helping them in some areas, it was interfering with them in other areas. It may be because of misinformation from the person who's providing the medication. The person may say, take this and you'll feel better, and then neglect to say, and you need to take this for the next 6 months, or you need to take this for the next 3 years. How many of us have been given an antibiotic for an infection, and the physician says, now you need, here's a 10-day supply. You take one 3 times a day for 30 days, here are your 30 pills. I'm watching the hands out there. How many of you always go the full 10 days? And what if it's 8 days, and you're starting to get a yeast infection, or you're starting to get gastric upset from it? Do you go the full 10 days or not? And that's no different. The brain is just an organ, just like the urinary bladder. It's just a part of the body, and it causes symptoms, and those symptoms can be attended to. The problem I see is that people look at they really over-identify with their brain. So when I give you the penicillin for your pneumonia, you say, fine, that's my lungs, they're down there somewhere. And when I give you prescribed the antidepressant for your depression, you say, hey, you're tinkering with my personality. That's really me. And I see your brain as no more really you than any other part of your body.
Richard, about 10 years ago, you ended a career as a professor of radiology at a medical school in Chicago and moved into psychiatry.
To Mendocino County.
And to Mendocino County. Why did you make that professional change?
Oh, there were a bunch of reasons, and you just asked that question. You used that word again like you did in the last interview. Why?
Why?
Why? Why, oh why?
But just because you don't like to ask why questions doesn't mean that I will stop.
It's okay. You can ask him. I had done everything I wanted to do in radiology, and I believe that as I got older, I fell into a pattern that has been described by Carl Jung, one of the giants in psychiatry, which is that the first part of our lives, we often spend understanding and conquering the world. So we learn how to read and write and make a living and go to the bathroom in the right places and to eat and to associate and to raise a family and whatever. And then once we've learned those things and we get pretty good at it, then we realize there's another world to conquer, and that's the world inside. And I thought it would be neat to go into a profession where that has a medical model to it, so I didn't have to change careers, so to speak. I could go from looking inside of people with x-rays to looking inside of people through words, and now with imaging techniques too, and to discover who I was and how I was, what made me tick and what made other people tick, And I find it fascinating to sit with people and to have them share with me their life story and find out what got them to this place, what's good about what got them to this place, that's the most important thing, and what's not so good about what has gotten them to this place, and what can we do together to change that.
And you're finding these out, who you are, who other people are?
Yeah.
These answers are coming? Did you have a retraining or a residency in psychiatry?
Oh, yes, it was really fun. I was simultaneously a full professor of radiology, and in the same medical school, I was a first-year resident in psychiatry. So I actually took off the radiology hat firmly and said to people I would not look at x-ray exams anymore, and I would just do the psychiatry thing. So after having had 4 previous post-medical school years of training, I went back and did 3 more years of training as a psychiatrist in order to prepare for becoming board certified in psychiatry.
Well, Richard Gardner, I want to thank you very much for joining us on Radio Curious and ask you the book question.
I thought you were going to forget that. Well, the book I read recently that I really enjoyed was by John Irving, and it's called The Cider House Rules. And it's not just because it's the story of a doctor and his lifespan, but it's and another doctor-to-be who comes along. But it's just a very fascinating tale that absolutely kept me spellbound for the whole time.
I agree. That's my recommendation about that book, too. Well, Richard Gardner, thank you very much for joining us.
Dr. Richard Gardner is a practicing psychiatrist in Ukiah, California. The book that he recommends is The Cider House Rules by John Irving. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.